Support for this podcast comes from San Francisco International Airport. At SFO, you can discover award-winning flavors and unique shops all before takeoff. Learn more about what's at SFO at flysfo.com.
Hey there, this is Brittany Luce from NPR's It's Been a Minute. KQED's podcasts like The Bay, Bay Curious, Mind Shift, Right Nowish, and more all tell the stories of the Bay and beyond with reliable, human-centered journalism. They aim to inspire, make you think, entertain, and expand your understanding of the place you call home. Here's how you can support podcasting at KQED.
Showing your support is easy, and you can join Brittany in supporting KQED Podcast too at donate.kqed.org/podcast. That's donate.kqed.org/podcast.
From KQED. This is Forum. I'm Marisa Lagos here today for Mina Kim. How do we get to the point where a 50-year-old Supreme Court opinion may now be overturned? We'll look at the decades-long organized political efforts that enabled this potential result and talk about what American politics and society might look like in a post-Roe world. All that ahead on Forum. Join us. This is Forum. I'm Marisa Lagos here today for Mina Kim. The leaked draft Supreme Court opinion overturning Roe v. Wade has sent shockwaves across the country, particularly for those who assume their 50-year-old constitutional right to abortion was safe. But court watchers have long predicted this outcome, brought on by a decades-long effort of Christian fundamentalists and other far-right actors to remake the Republican Party. We're going to talk about the political forces that brought us to this moment and the other core privacy rights from contraception to gay marriage that may be imperiled. Joining me to explore how we got here and where we're going in this post-Roe world are Jay Michelson, journalist and contributing writer at The Daily Beast and New York Magazine. His most recent piece for The Daily Beast is Gay Marriage is Next on the SCOTUS Chopping Block, and he also has an article in Rolling Stone magazine called Roe v. Wade is on Life Support, How the F Did We Get Here? Michelson is also a rabbi. Jay, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
We also have with us Aziza Ahmed, a professor of law at UC Irvine Law School. Her forthcoming book from Cambridge University Press is Risk and Resistance, How Feminists Changed the Law and Science of AIDS. Aziza, very happy you could join us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So as I said, I was hoping we could use the first half of the show or so to look back and kind of talk about how we ended up in the situation that we believe we'll be facing if this draft opinion is codified in the coming weeks. So, Jay, let's go back to the beginning of the nation, because Justice Alito seems to want to. What was the state of abortion in the 1800s as this nation was, you know, sort of in its nascent stages?
So that's the perfect place to start. So part of what's incredibly frustrating, obviously there's so much that's unjust and difficult in Justice Alito's draft, but some of what's so frustrating is his selective use of history. So he points out, oh, well, abortion's not mentioned in the Constitution, and it's not here and it's not there. It was really nowhere in American law. Abortion was just not considered something that was going to be regulated by the government really until the middle of the 19th century and to the late 19th century. And that was under pressure of the medical establishment, which for sort of fundamentally, I'd say, sexist reasons, wanted to sort of take power from midwives and others who were taking care of women's health, what was called women's health care.
So it wasn't a moral objection at that point.
There were, you know, there was church teaching, but really only the Catholic Church held that life began at contraception. In fact, as late as the 1960s and 1970s, even when Roe versus Wade was decided, a majority of conservative Protestants and conservative evangelicals in the United States believe that life began at birth.
And we'll get to that.
Okay. Yeah. So 19th century, yes, that was going on. Abortion is as old as sex, but this was not something that was widely regulated, especially not before what was called quickening, which is a term we don't really use today, but it was about when the mother could feel the fetus moving within the womb, which is about 16 weeks. Mm-hmm. And before that time, this was just not considered something that the government was going to regulate at all.
And Aziza, I mean, a lot of this, what's in this opinion is sort of looking back at the history and making, you know, contextualizing it. But we know that history is written, especially in this country, often by men and white men specifically. So to Jay's point, like, how do you sort of view the historical context of the early, you know, U.S. and how we're talking about it now?
Yeah, I think, you know, what's always been clear, and this is something that Jay is alluding to as well, is that even as, you know, people have always had really mixed and contested ideas about, you know, when life begins and how we should think about childbirth and how we should think about the embryo, how we should think about pregnancy. I think what's most shocking about the opinion and its historical account is that it completely writes out the experiences of women and people who have been pregnant and need abortions. It's almost as though their lives, their realities, their existences don't matter to how we understand American history. All that matters is the, you know, deep thoughts of famous jurists, some of whom have extremely problematic histories themselves.
Yeah. Do you want to give any specific examples or anything that really struck you in this draft opinion in that frame?
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, we just, you know, I think the main thing for me was that at the time when these jurists were writing, we knew very little about pregnancy and about, you know, the science of the embryo or the science of the fetus. These were really just the ruminations of men who were empowered to essentially think through their ideas about abortion and how people's bodies ought to be governed. They weren't feminists, you know, they weren't anyone who had inclinations towards women's rights or the inclusivity of women. And so, you know, there's a certain absurdity to the fact that the Supreme Court went back to this period, you know, the 16th century, the 17th century, the 18th century, to try to understand how to deal with an issue that is central to women's health, mental health, and economic survival today.
Yeah. And Jay Michelson, I mean, can you bring us forward from the 1800s to the 1960s? What kind of political, if any, debate was there around this issue from, you know, then up to the time where I know you've written about it being legalized in various states through a coalition we probably wouldn't recognize these days?
That's right. Although I can't miss out on the opportunity to just bash one of the 17th century sources that just, because I completely agree with everything that Professor Ahmed just said. And even within these sort of patriarchal sources that are so impartial and where women's voices and existences do not appear, the ones that Justice Alito chose were outrageous. So one of the sources that he cited approvingly is also said in the same set of documents that a husband cannot be guilty of rape because a wife is his property. This is the same individual sentenced women to death for witchcraft. These are the supporting sources that Justice Alito is using, and as sort of setting forth, you know, the wonderful tradition of Anglo-American law on reproductive rights. Yeah. So even within the entire system, which is itself shot through, you know, with misogyny and with exclusion and with all the problems that we know about, he even chose the worst ones, some of the worst ones within that system.
Well, anyway, let me ask you. No. It's a good tangent. And I'm curious, Jay, like, is this common? I mean, is it unusual for a justice to go back that far and to cite the types of sources you're talking about? Like, does that strike you as sort of within the normal bounds of jurisprudence these days?
These days, it is rather common. And the reason is that, at least on paper, Justice Alito and other conservative justices subscribe to a theory called originalism, which is to understand what the Constitution says, we have to try to think, I would say imagine, but they would say research, you know, what the writers, what the founders were thinking when they wrote these words. You know, as, you know, just not someone who just went to law school, but also grads, like, that's a preposterous activity. But that's what originalists believe, is that we can get to the original meanings of words like liberty or the rights retained by the people, these sort of very broad words that are used in the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. And, you know, until the 1970s or so, the predominant view was the Constitution used these broad words for a reason. Right. The idea was that you would interpret these norms differently across history. And that's why there are these broad basic norms about liberty and about, you know, the word privacy isn't there, but the concept of a personal zone that the government doesn't enter into. But when originalism kind of came on the scene as an instrument of what I would say hard right conservative interpretations of the Constitution, that's when we started seeing these cites to very obscure sources, you know, from the 17th and 18th centuries, because supposedly those sources shed light on what the founders meant when they used words like liberty.
Yeah. Okay. So before we get to Roe, Jay, tell us, you know, quickly, just like where were things in the 60s when this coalition you write about that was led by feminists, but also included religious leaders, was helping legalize this in some states?
Yeah, there's, you know, there's a conception today that this is sort of a religion versus secular fight, right? And that religion, because of sort of certain right-wing elements within the Christian fundamentalist community have tried to monopolize and sometimes successfully monopolize public discourse, it's being put as like, this is like God versus women. A few years ago, I wrote a book called God versus Gay, because the same false polarity is used in LGBTQ issues. But that's not actually true. Some of the leading activists for legalizing abortion in the 1960s were liberal clergy, because what happened in the roughly 100 years from around 1870 to 1970 is that, of course, abortions continued to be performed, right? They were just being performed outside the law by, you know, in unqualified people, by shady people. Women were being harmed. Women were tragically were being killed. I mean, this is not, it didn't stop. Criminalizing abortion doesn't stop abortion. It just stops safe abortion. Mm-hmm. And so this became seen as a sort of human rights issue and a religious issue by progressives. So it was a coalition of feminists and of liberal clergy in the 60s. And it became understood at that time that this was not just sort of a health and safety issue, but one about fundamental bodily autonomy, that this was about the humanity of women and being empowered to make choices about their own bodies, which it sounds like a cliche to talk about now, and yet that's what's being contested in this draft opinion.
Yeah. We just have a couple minutes till the break, and I want to come back to Professor Ahmed after that to talk about Roe. But just quickly, Jay, can you just tell us, like, what was public opinion like leading in the decade leading up to this court case? Was this an issue that folks were thinking about in the political sphere or just generally?
Outside of the Catholic Church, this was not a major issue. As I mentioned before, a majority of evangelicals, conservative evangelicals, did not think that abortion was ending a human life. They did not see this as a religious imperative, let alone a political imperative. The issue was the decision was controversial when it came down, but really only among a small subset of the population. And hopefully after the break, we can talk about how that changed. But it may be a head scratcher, but it is the case that conservative evangelicals were not focused in any way on abortion. And when church leaders wrote on the issue, they wrote saying that life begins at birth, not conception.
Wow. All right. We're going to keep talking after a short break about the political history of how we got to this point with Roe v. Wade, that 50-year-old Supreme Court case that, based on a leaked draft opinion, looks like it's about to be overturned. And we're going to talk about what the world could look like post-Roe. We want to know from our audience, what rights are you afraid might be lost if Roe is overturned? How are you responding to the court's leaked opinion? And what questions do you have about what's behind us and what's ahead? You can give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Or you can get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum. You can also email your questions to forum@kqed.org. I'm Marisa Lagos, and for Mina Kim, we'll be right back.
We'll be right back.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Marisa Lagos, and today for Mina Kim, and we are talking about that draft leaked Supreme Court decision, which, if it stands, would overturn the 1973 landmark case Roe v. Wade. I'm here with Jay Michelson, journalist and contributing writer at The Daily Beast and New York Magazine, and Aziza Ahmed, professor of law at UC Irvine Law School. And Aziza, can you talk us through how that landmark case came before the court in 1973? What were the basic outlines of it?
Right, yeah. So basically, Roe was a case brought by several people, and there's a companion case to Doe versus Bolton. And the case challenged the criminal laws in the state of Texas, and basically the ability of physicians to actually perform abortions and not have a criminal liability. The Roe case became very important because it essentially then decriminalized abortion. And it became, it was a historic moment in US history. It was a high point for the feminist movement. And it was also an important period in which the anti-choice activists began to organize. What Roe said is that basically, within the scope of the right to privacy, which can be found in different places in the Constitution, but most importantly connected to the idea of liberty, women have the right to choose an abortion. And the state has, at different points in pregnancy, essentially different interests in the ability to either stop abortion altogether or to regulate abortion. Now, this changed, of course, once we got to the 90s and we got to the Casey decision, which changed the rule a bit.
Yeah. So, and I want to get there, but Jay, before we go there, talk about the line and the politics that emerges related to Roe v. Wade and school desegregation. Like, how do those things have anything to do with each other?
So, yeah, this can be kind of a head scratcher also for people when they learn about it. I would just, for what I'm going to say, I'll also point to the work of historian Randall Balmer, who really traces this in detail. So, again, it will surprise people to hear that abortion was just not that galvanizing an issue for religious conservatives in the 1970s. In fact, and in the 1960s, the predominant attitude was really to stay out of politics because politics was messy and we just want to keep pure and keep free of all of that mess. That changed with school desegregation in the 60s and 70s. As soon as desegregation really happened, most white conservative Christians pulled their kids out of public schools and into what were later called segregation academies. These were religious schools that only admitted white students. So basically, if they couldn't have whites-only schools in the public school system, they created their own system of white schools. That was later found to be against the Civil Rights Act, maybe obviously, but it was not obvious that that would actually apply to religious schools. The law was applied to religious schools, and that is when there was a coalescing of what we now know as the Christian right in the mid-1970s.
And this includes Jerry Falwell, right?
That's right. So Jerry Falwell, Paul Weyrich, and others began kind of revising the notion that evangelicals should stay out of politics because politics was getting in the way of their having all white learning environments for their children. And that was what brought the Christian right together. At the same time, for a number of reasons, that was not seen as an issue that could be the kind of public face of the movement, partly because public opinion had shifted in the intervening 10 years and saying we're an officially racist movement and we want to have racist schools forever. So there was, we have the documents. I mean, this isn't like a matter of interpretation.
The receipts are there.
Liberal. We have the receipts, exactly. And it's not, you know, so that we have the minutes of the meetings, we have direct interviews. Abortion was seen as an issue that could unite the different sides of what now became the Christian right, in particular Catholics and Protestants. There was actually a fair amount of anti-Catholic prejudice among Protestant communities throughout the 20th century. And actually, this view on life begins at conception was one of the things that Protestants sort of made fun of about Catholics. Like, this is a ridiculous idea. It's not in the Bible. How could anyone believe this? That all changed roughly between 1975 and 1985. The election of Ronald Reagan with the support of the moral majority in the Christian right showed that when conservative white Christian conservatives got involved in politics, they could change the results of a presidential election. And within a very short time, opposition to abortion became the absolute litmus test for almost any Republican politician, and certainly sort of a kind of article of faith among conservative white evangelicals.
Yeah. And so we see this really... Aziza flourished through the 80s. You know, Ronald Reagan, who actually ironically signed one of California's legalizing abortion laws, became president in part backed by this coalition. Bring us up, though, to 1992 and that Casey decision you mentioned before. How did that interact with Roe? And I know you've written, you know, talked about how it's actually not a very progressive decision, even though it's all often held up as sort of this partner to the Roe v. Wade decision.
Right. Yeah. So Casey had to do with a law in Pennsylvania that was passed that essentially introduced a bunch of barriers to abortion, including a waiting period and an informed consent, sort of an excessive informed consent piece to accessing abortion. And the Casey decision, even as we fall back on it now, is an opportunity, is where we hope the justices would actually land. At the time, it was extremely conservative because it found all of these provisions of the Pennsylvania law that were designed to limit access to abortion to be constitutional. And they did so by basically saying that they created a new rule, essentially, that said that any law that has the purpose or effect of placing a substantial obstacle in the path of a woman seeking an abortion of a non-viable fetus would be unconstitutional. But they basically, over the years, courts essentially used this rule to say that no laws that were being introduced either had the purpose of essentially creating this obstacle or the effect of creating this obstacle. Mm. And so actually Casey allowed for a lot of abortion restrictions to essentially come into play and survive constitutional challenges. But so it's kind of speaks to the moment we're in, that a decision that at the time was viewed as extremely conservative and people weren't really celebrating it, progressives weren't really celebrating at the time, has now become, you know, sort of our hope for where the Supreme Court will go.
Yeah. And sticking with you for a second, Jay had talked about, you know, this connection between originalism mm-hmm. and the abortion debate and this idea that, you know, it has to be part of a nation's history and traditions in order to be constitutional. Is that something that was already kind of part of the more conservative legal movement at the time, or has that really developed in the last 20 or 30 years?
Well, I think Jay's history of originalism is absolutely correct, that it wasn't something that has existed forever. It was a particular constitutional theory that was invented. Conservatives largely, though you can see originalism and textualism if you read the entire, you know, body of constitutional law, or you read a lot of it anyways, you know, is deployed depending on whatever the particular justice wants to achieve as a judicial outcome, but it is most frequently used by conservatives because, of course, if you go back to the 16th and 17th century at a time when only white men and only property holding people in many cases had rights, it serves a particular contemporary project as well.
Well, I mean, slavery was legal at our nation's founding, right? Like,
exactly.
I know we enshrined ending that in the Constitution, but I mean, if you follow this logic out, it feels like a lot of things that we kind of take for granted could be threatened. I mean, we have one commenter, Michael, who just wants to know, has it ever happened that a constitutionally guaranteed right has been taken away?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the entire, well, you know, it depends on how you think of a right. Rights just don't work for progressives. You know, conservatives claim rights, progressives claim rights. And, you know, you could say that a person's right to be, trying to think of a good example here, but, you know, basically Lochner, for example, which is a very famous historical case. They, you know, they basically said during the Lochner era, which was at the start of the Great Depression, the courts were basically saying that contained within the right to liberty is the right to contract. And by the time you get to West Coast Hotel, they say, no, I'm sorry, that the right to liberty can't be conceptualized in this way. So in that sense, a particular idea or understanding of a right to contract that was actually hurting workers was taken away. Mm-hmm. So, you know, rights are always sort of granted and taken away by the state. So I think that's probably a better way of thinking about rights, because then it helps us see how we're all kind of grabbing for the same set of resources.
Okay. There's also been a tremendous erosion in Fourth Amendment rights. So the rights against search and seizure in the last several years. And it'll probably surprise most listeners to know that even the Miranda right that you're meant to, you know, you have a right to remain silent. We all know from TV shows, the odds are very high that it will be taken away and not found to be required by the Constitution. At least if you know, we'll see how that case comes out in the next little while. But, you know, in terms of the Fourth Amendment in general and the right to privacy and be free from search and seizure, there have been all kinds of incursions on what were formerly held to be pretty clear rights, both under the pretext of the drug war and in other contexts. And it's absolutely true. I mean, these are something about the notion of fundamental rights. Well, it sounds fundamental and foundational, but these are really precarious. And you know, the network of rights around the right to abortion is all imperiled by the draft decision.
Yeah. I want to bring in a caller, Nan in Santa Clara. Nan, go ahead.
Hi, I work in healthcare right now, and like it's across the board understood that reproductive health is a right. Like there's still very progressive cities in California that are unable to provide this resources because of the lack of like funding and stuff. So how can you expect states with pretty much like zero public funding for healthcare to really meet like the demand now? And if you're going to take this away, are you going to give us an alternative, such as like birth control, teaching like sex, teaching all this stuff in schools to educate the mass? And I don't really see that coming. And it's extremely hypocritical to impose this on us. But if it were to happen in their own personal sphere, I'm pretty sure things would be different. And it's just, it just seems so backwards to refer to resources from archaic times in the same line as like witchcraft and apply it to modern day. Like our nation, like quote unquote tradition, is consisting of racism, sexism, and classism. And to bring that back almost seems like a personal benefit and agenda. And like the most frustrating part of it is that the public polls, like the public does not want this to happen. They are advocating for abortion and reproductive rights. And these individuals who work in the federal government, who work in the Supreme Court justice, whose job is to protect and advocate for the people's right, it doesn't make any sense for them to do the complete opposite of it.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Nan. We really appreciate your phone call. You know, I want to talk about the other potential rights that could be under attack next. But before we get there, I think it's important, Jay, to underline just the fact that this was not, it's not an accident that we're here, right? This was a concerted political and legal strategy, which, of course, started after Roe, but has really continued over the past few decades. And I'm just curious, like, you know, it's about electing folks who were anti-abortion. It was about stacking the courts with jurists who are also anti-abortion. But there was a specific legal strategy here as well, right? And do you think that ultimately it is just about abortion, or has it always been a kind of broader legal strategy?
Oh, it's definitely not just about abortion, although that would be troubling enough if it were. Now, the caller is absolutely right. I mean, the pro-life movement is not pro-life, right, in any real way. If you were pro-life, you would want enough health care for any woman who needed it. You would want child care. You would want paid child leave, right? Like most civilized countries, you know, you would want to be so that women, especially single mothers, wouldn't have to choose between working and taking care of their new new children. There's a whole agenda that would be a really nice agenda if we were truly pro-life, right? This is just a forced birth movement. This is a control of women's bodies movement, and it's a patriarchy movement. And the same, so the right to privacy, which Aziza referred to earlier, which is the notion that there is this kind of personal zone beyond which the government cannot go, that's the same basis for not just the right to my marriage, same-sex marriage, and marriage equality, also the right to any same-sex activity. We've maybe forget that quote unquote sodomy was illegal in many states until it was overturned by the Supreme Court. The quote unquote right to privacy is underlies that. Even the right to use contraception, and even the right that people of different ethnic groups, they would say different races, interracial marriage, even that rests on the right to privacy. And if you think about it, of course, I mean, why shouldn't the government regulate all of these things if it wants to? Well, the reason is that there's this notion of personal privacy and autonomy, and I would say sort of dignity and inside of these fundamental rights in the Constitution. Yeah. But once that's taken away, then we really get to see the full ambit of what this campaign has always been about, which has been about turning back the clock to a mythical time in which fundamentalist white fundamentalist Christians were the hegemonic group. Their values were the shared values. That's what it means, make America great again. It means return to the illusion of, let's say, 1950s America, in which a certain type of person dominated. The sort of dominated power and political power, as well as culture in this country.
Yeah. We're talking about the political history of Roe v. Wade and abortion rights and the leaked draft opinion that indicates that the court may be overturning it. We're talking with Jay Michelson, journalist and contributing writer at The Daily Beast and New York Magazine, as well as Professor Aziza Ahmed. And if you want to tell us what rights you're worried about could be lost if Roe's overturned, how you're responding to this court ruling, potential court ruling, or what questions you have, you can give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum. And you can email your questions to forum@kqed.org. Susan writes, did Alito really include the fact that there's now a reduction in the stigma associated with unmarried mothers so we can now force them to go forward with an unwanted pregnancy? What kind of mind thinks that social stigma is the reason one would terminate a pregnancy? Professor Ahmed, can you respond to that? Because it really did strike me reading this, watching the oral arguments, because Amy Coney Barrett brought this up too, that they do seem to be making an argument that because it's not as stigmatized to have a child out of wedlock, that somehow a woman's body, you know, that 40 weeks is not an intrusion on somebody's sort of constitutional rights to be forced to do anything.
Right. And can, you know, I think the irony of all that as well is that it's not as though if there was a stigma, it's not as though if we did treat women badly in society who were pregnant, this would have turned out any differently. You know, I'm not convinced that the court really cares how women are treated in their communities to begin with. But yeah, I mean, this idea that it's just, you know, carrying a pregnancy to term just isn't really that big of a deal came out really clearly in the oral arguments, because Amy Coney Barrett, I think, to the shock of many people, suggested that basically having an abortion was the same as carrying a pregnancy to term and giving up the child, you know, sort of using the protections of safe haven laws, which, you know, essentially allow you to leave your child at a fire station or in the hospital if you can't care for the child. And I think people were rightly shocked by this idea that one would equate the entire experience of pregnancy, the dangers of pregnancy, with having an abortion, something that could essentially, both events could essentially change your financial stability, your financial precarity. And it's really worth mentioning that for some groups of women, like Black women, yeah, it is really dangerous in this country, especially depending on where you live, like in the state of Texas, to have a child. Maternal mortality rates and morbidity rates are really high. And, you know, it's a scary experience in this country to have a child if you're a Black woman, to get your voice heard in the clinical setting. This has been proven in studies over and over. So we have to think about that as well.
Yeah, and I want to hit more on that racial aspect, which is important, as well as the gender one. I'm Marisa Lagos, and for Mina Kim today, we're talking about this week's leaked Supreme Court decision on Roe v. Wade and what might be next. Please give us a call if you want to tell us your concerns or questions. We're at 866-733-6786. You can get in touch on Twitter and Facebook at KQED Forum or email your questions to forum@kqed.org. I'm Marisa Lagos. We'll be right back.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Marisa Lagos, in today for Mina Kim. We are talking about this week's leaked Roe v. Wade draft decision by Justice Alito and what a world would look like without that 50-year-old court precedent protecting a woman's right to choose an abortion. I want to play a cut for y'all from Governor Gavin Newsom. You know, a lot of blue states are really working to shore up their abortion networks in anticipation of this ruling. And the governor spoke this week pretty forcefully at Planned Parenthood in Los Angeles about what he worries could happen next.
Don't think for a second. This is where they stop. And if you think it affects someone else over there, this is about you. If the right to privacy is not foundational, they're coming after you. They are. Fill in the blank. Who is you? It's us. It's all of us. Across a spectrum of issues. You think for a second same-sex marriage is safe in the United States of America? Give me a break.
And Aziza Ahmed, what's your take on this? I know Jay has spoken and written about gay marriage, for example, as potentially under sort of threat from this. Contraception, we talked about, you know, private sexual activity. Is that because all of those rulings were based in part on the same sort of underlying assumption of the 14th Amendment and this idea of equal protection?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So, you know, basically what Scalia and Thomas have been saying for decades, and many conservative Supreme Court justices, and as well as Supreme Court, I mean, conservative thought leaders, is essentially that any right that's not specifically found in the Constitution, it's not an enumerated right of the Constitution, essentially it is just when the court sort of declares something like that as a right, like the right to privacy, it's basically just the court doing politics, you know, and they should, the court's not supposed to be in the business of doing politics. They shouldn't be in the business of essentially taking a political position on behalf of the people. Those kinds of decisions should be left to the states. And so you have to then go back and say, all right, well, what are all the cases that are linked to this right of privacy that seems like it's about to be sort of written out of our constitutional doctrine and analysis? And it's, you know, it is gay marriage. It is rights associated with marriage and family. It is simply same-sex sexual relationships, like Jay mentioned, you know, Lawrence v. Texas, which was only in 2003, you know, right. And a lot of, I think a lot of us remember the days pre-2003, and even where there wasn't that much enforcement of the laws, there was a a cloud, you know, over, I think, American society that said to people, you know, and that signaled to LGBT people that like the sex you're having is essentially criminal.
Right.
And all of that progress that we've made to build a society that's more sort of accepting and open is basically on the chopping block.
Yeah. We're getting a ton of comments, so I want to get to some of these and questions. Jay, quickly, can you tell us the name of the book you mentioned about evangelical history again? A listener is asking.
The historian is named Randall Balmer, B-A-L-M-E-R. And he actually had an article in The Guardian last fall, if you don't want to go read the whole several books he's written, kind of summarizing that. And he links to his longer work.
Okay, I'm going to bring in a caller in just a sec, but I also wanted to have you, Jay, respond to this tweet. I understand the historical background and legal possibilities, but could these over-the-top predictions hurt Democrats' arguments? And I would just add the question, like, and are we already seeing legal forces line up to do, you know, to challenge these cases? How are these predictions based on what we're already seeing or just the sort of broader context?
Oh, it's on what we're already seeing. I'll put in one caveat. Just obviously, you know, we want to be truthful about, you know, the threats that are there, but we also don't want to just exaggerate too much. This is a draft opinion. It does seem that at least Justice Kavanaugh, and obviously there's a huge irony here that it's Justice Kavanaugh who might be the moderate in favor of women's rights. But nonetheless,
he does leave that there. Yeah,
I'm just going to leave that there. He does have a more moderate view than Justice Alito that he's expressed at oral argument and in some of his published writing as well. It's possible that we might have a slightly narrower final decision than this draft decision. So, for example, Roe versus Wade could still be overturned, but all of the extra language that's in Justice Alito's draft about the right to privacy, that doesn't really need to be there. And it's possible that even if that opinion goes, Justice Kavanaugh, certainly Chief Justice Roberts, two conservatives, by the way, these are not liberal heroes, they may not join in that. So we may have a slightly narrower opinion than the draft that we've just gotten. That is a possibility. Having said that, several justices on the court have gone out of their way to question the marriage right. Justice Gorsuch and Justice Thomas and Justice Alito have written in concurring and dissenting opinions, first limiting same-sex marriage, basically saying that, well, you can have marriage, but marriage doesn't have to be the same as straight marriage. So there was a case involving conditions on gay marriage that didn't exist for straight marriage. And do companies have to recognize your same-sex marriage? Well, maybe not, because it's not the same as, it doesn't have to be the same as a straight marriage. So we've already seen incursions on the marriage right. And Justice Alito in the draft expressly mentioned Obergefell, which was the same-sex marriage decision, as falling under this same mistaken constitutional interpretation that there might be some kind of right to privacy. So this is not, you know,
hyperbolic.
We're not going crazy here. It's written in the draft opinion, and it's been in other Supreme Court opinions as well.
Yeah. And I'm sure we are going to have plenty of time to unpack on forum and other KQED shows the politics, the fallout of this. But I want to bring in Berkeley from Oakland with a question for our panel. Berkeley, go ahead.
Yeah, hi, thank you so much. So my understanding is that in order to bring a legal case, you have to prove that you have standing. And I don't understand how anyone could possibly have standing over what I do with my own body.
Amazing question. Professor, you want to take that one?
Yeah, sure. So yes, that's a really good question. And I think it kind of gets to the heart of bodily autonomy and privacy. I think states are looking for creative ways essentially to control women's bodies, control the bodies of people who need abortions. And, you know, we see this in Texas, for example, where the state has basically granted standing to anyone who wants to sue an abortion provider for doing an abortion before 6 weeks. You know, we can see, you know, it's not the same issue as standing, but, you know, if we see criminal action, prosecutions of women who tried to self-induce their abortion or to try to have abortions, you know, it's kind of giving the state the authority and power over a person's body. In that case, you would have to defend yourself against the state essentially saying that you've tried to commit an illegal act. So, yeah, great question.
Also, I know some states are trying to create laws to prevent women from leaving to get an abortion in other states. That seems very shaky to me, but I'm not a lawyer. So can you also respond to that?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, it's really complicated. And I think the current consensus among scholars who are thinking about how the criminal laws and these sort of what so-called travel bans are going to intersect is a bit unclear. But right now, states are experimenting essentially with passing laws that say, or writing laws that say that essentially a person can't leave the state and go get an abortion elsewhere, because when they return, they'll be prosecuted. Alternatively, that they might try to go and find the physician to prosecute, or alternatively, that if a physician travels into a state to do an abortion, that they could be prosecuted. We're kind of in fuzzy territory here. There's a whole range of laws and rules and that basically suggest that states should cooperate. There's ways that states could specifically say that they won't cooperate when it comes to prosecutions related to abortion. Connecticut has passed a law like this one. The state of California, you know, is putting protections into place for women who are coming here to seek abortions. I think the real thing to take away, though, is that while we are in this gray area, a lot of women are going to be prosecuted, because we're kind of in a new and unprecedented moment where the right is really trying out everything in its most cruel fashion. And I think it's just a matter of time, as we already saw in Texas, before a woman essentially gets prosecuted and they make her poor life is dragged through the system, as we're all trying to figure out whether or not this is okay, whether or not it's constitutional or unconstitutional.
You know, and just for perspective, to add to that excellent analysis, 4 years or a few years ago, 6 years ago, when Donald Trump was running for president, you know, he's kind of new to being pro-life, because he wasn't anti-abortion his whole life. So somebody asked him kind of a gotcha question, which is, well, would you prosecute women for getting an abortion? Because most of the laws are actually targeted toward doctors, toward abortion providers. So it was a bad talking point. Like, what you're supposed to say if you're anti-abortion is, no, we would never prosecute women. We only want to prosecute the doctors. But Donald Trump didn't know that. So he said, well, I guess we would prosecute women. And there was a huge blowback against that. That was only 6 years ago. And now, as Aziza just said, that's actually happening. Now there are laws which would actually target women. So in just the span of 6 years, like a really short period of time, we moved from something being too outrageous, even for the anti-abortion right to say, to something that's actually in law.
And I just have to underscore, I mean, the idea of telling a woman that she cannot leave her home state to go do really anything she wants somewhere else just blows my mind. I'm going to leave that there. Robin writes, anti-abortion proponents seem to claim there is a religious rationale, but I've read the Bible and it never refers to abortion. The only reference in Genesis indirectly indicates that a fetus, if killed during a fight in which the pregnant woman is injured, is treated as property and a fine must be paid as damages. Just going to leave that one there.
Well, I can put my rabbi hat on for a moment. Not only is abortion itself not mentioned, but that is actually a really important biblical verse, because the Bible never talks about this issue, but it does have exactly, it's actually in I think Leviticus, not Genesis, but that text is exactly correct. So there is a case where there's like, if somebody in the Old Testament, there is capital punishment. If somebody killed someone, they were supposed to be put to death. That was never actually done in practice, but that was what's in the letter of the law. So if a fetus were a human life and somebody, kind of, God forbid, killed a pregnant woman, attacked the pregnant woman, killed the fetus, that would be murder, right? And that should be punished as murder. But in fact, the biblical text says it's not punished as murder, which means that it's not a human life, which means that, again, this is like a thread of a thread of a thread. It seems like a very fine point. But because the Bible never talks about any of these issues, which you would think if this was important, it might get a mention, right? Never gets a mention. The one time it sort of does talk about it is on the other side, that this is not a human life. It may be a potential human life. It may be something like Aziza said at the top, you know, this has been a contested issue with some voices being heard and others not. It's contested, right? This is back and forth. So the one little sliver of religious teaching on this is on the opposite side of where religious conservatives find themselves today.
You are listening to Forum. I'm Marisa Lagos in for Mina Kim. We're talking about the draft leak SCOTUS decision with Jay Michelson, journalist and contributing writer at The Daily Beast and New York Magazine, and Aziza Ahmed, professor of law at UC Irvine Law School. We have some other comments coming in. Jesse writes, "It blows my mind to hear that people say life matters and in the same breath discount homelessness, turn people away at the border, lock people up for minor drug offenses, and dictate who a person wants to be. The loudest are those who claim to be Christian, but that is not how I was taught to be Christ-like." Amy wants to know, if life starts at conception, then when does child support start? Would it start immediately when a woman found out she was pregnant? Aziza, this, I think, you know, is a legitimate question, but also gets to some of these sort of critiques that there's not actually as much respect once a baby is born for supporting that life.
Right. Yeah, there, exactly. I mean, if we know that, you know, many mothers in this country, many single mothers in this country, many of whom, you know, are Black and Latina, who are poor, who are struggling, get virtually no support from the government. And families have suffered through this pandemic. You know, we don't support mothers and we don't support children in this country. And it's shocking to think that someone can actually, you know, that conservatives can actually even try to make the claim that who they care about is children, you know, given the other types of laws that are supported by conservatives at this moment. You know, and I think, you know, the question also gets to something else, which is really coming down the pike too, if this decision does come to fruition, which is that, you know, there are a lot of people who make embryos through IVF and other assisted reproductive technologies. And, you know, if we deem, you know, that if we decide that, you know, a child, you know, that a life begins prior to basically at fertilization or at conception, then, you know, we're basically having to come up with a whole new scheme for how we're going to think about issues like assisted reproduction and what we're going to do with all the embryos that are currently in freezers all over the country that have been produced through this process. And, you know, how will we deal with wills and trusts? You know, who will get inheritance? How do we think about it? Do we need to include those embryos when we think about next of kin? I mean, it's opening the door to a huge Pandora's box of complicated legal issues that I'm not sure we're ready to deal with.
Yeah, definitely. I want to bring in another caller, Paige from Sonoma. Go ahead, Paige.
Hi there. My comment is, I know, going to sound a little over the top, but my concern is for women who sadly go through miscarriages or lose their child that way. I feel like this concept of persecuting the women or the doctors, the providers, at what point is this finger pointing going to become that, well, you had a miscarriage, but I saw you had a glass of wine. Maybe you caused that miscarriage. And therefore, at what point is it that I think it's a fine line between, okay, my body can choose to have an abortion. My brain cannot choose.
Paige, thank you for the call. And this isn't actually an extreme concern because we've seen two women in recent years prosecuted in California for this. Who wants to take that one?
Well, I can, you know, I'll just say that we have seen, you know, for a very long time, and there was a real uptick of this in the 1980s, the prosecution of women for their behaviors during pregnancy. We really zoned in the 1980s on women who were using drugs. It was part of the war on drugs. It was a racialized attack on, you know, poor women, and we see a racist attack on poor women, and we saw it continue during the opioid crisis as well, that women were essentially being prosecuted for what you could call their behaviors during pregnancy. And it is interesting to think about the fact that, you know, we haven't had, of course, I'm sure very many cases exist, but we haven't had the same kind of moral outrage at women having a glass of wine during pregnancy. I think it says something about the class and race dynamics of, you know, who has a glass of wine at dinner versus people who are dealing with communities who are dealing with sort of bigger issues of addiction. But, you know, we've seen this for a long time. It's going to keep happening. You know, we're going to see prosecutions for people who claim they've had miscarriages and stillbirths, and instead, the states accusing them of having self-induced. It's happening now, and this is only going to make it worse.
All right, we only have like a minute left, but Joan writes in that she thinks our guest's comment about the pro-life movement being primarily about the patriarchy controlling women's bodies is misguided, that a large component of the pro-life movement is women who feel it's unethical to take the life of an unborn child, and that claiming most pro-lifers are religious fanatics and white men bent on propping up the patriarchy is inaccurate and damaging to the prospect of ever coming to an agreement. Jay, do you have like 10 seconds to respond?
I think it's perfectly fine to have a religious view about abortion. What's not perfectly fine is using the instruments of the state and the carceral state and power to force women to obey that decision.
Yeah, and just underscoring that supporting abortion rights doesn't mean you yourself love the idea of abortion. All right, we're going to have to leave it there. We have been talking about how we got here with Roe v. Wade and what might happen next. I want to thank our guest, Jay Michelson, journalist and contributing writer at The Daily Beast and New York Magazine. He's also a rabbi. And Aziza Ahmed, professor of law at UC Irvine Law School. Thank you so much to you both.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Forum. I'm Marisa Lagos in for Mina Kim. See you tomorrow.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, and the Heising Simons Foundation.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.